But if you would like, take your Bibles out, turn them to the first chapter of the book of Romans. We're going to study the last few verses of that chapter this evening. In the first part of the chapter of Romans, Paul has gone through some things, addressing himself to those who are at Rome and commending them, saying that their faith has been spoken of throughout the world. And he had been planning for some time to come to them. And he starts there in verse 15. He says, "So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also." And then in verse 16, a very familiar verse to all of us, he tells us why. "I'm ready to preach the gospel because I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek." So we're going to take a look at tonight at some of the things Paul is going to have to say about the gospel. This is not the only verse in the Bible. And it's not the end of a thought. It's actually the beginning of a thought. So when we're talking about being ashamed, Paul had an attitude towards the gospel that he was going to preach it. And we'll see how he was going to preach it here in just a few minutes. But the reason he was not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it, that being the gospel, is the power that God uses, the power that God has to save the individual. So what Paul is saying is, I'm not ashamed to preach salvation to the people that are willing to listen. And he says it's the power of God for everyone. For everyone. Now we know the Old Testament, when we looked at the difference between the Jews and the Gentiles, that God did not give the law of Moses specifically to the Gentiles. We understand that there were some proselytes. But in its inception, the law of Moses was given just to the Jews, but this gospel that Paul is preaching is for everyone. Everyone who believes. Now we have to understand this particular point here is that a lot of people today believe that God is going to save us, but they don't have the belief. This is only power is only activated by belief. You know, it's kind of like going out here in the car. Your car is activated only when you turn the key on. If you don't turn the key on, it's sitting there ready to go, but it may sit there for a week until somebody turns the key. The power of God is turned on, if you will, by belief. But notice also it says, to the Jew first and also for the Greek. We've been made aware of in the last several years, and probably in the last few months by Brother Keith, that there are those out there right now who are talking about the fact that there is a gospel for the Jew and a gospel for the Greek. They want to put Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the first few parts of Acts into the Old Testament and do away with it. Terrence McLean out here, who used to run the Bible bookstore over there, wants to do that so he can get around baptism. We can put baptism in the Old Testament. It's an old Jew. That's not for us Gentiles. Us Gentiles are saved by faith only. Well, that's a different gospel. But you notice in the passage here that the word gospel is singular. There's no S on the end of that word. Gospels. Paul didn't say, "I am not ashamed of the gospels of Christ." He said, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." But he says when he gets down there, it's for the Jew and also for the Greek. You'll notice in the English there's that little conjunction "and" in the text. That "and" joins two things of equal grammatical importance. Joins the Jew and the Greek. They're equal grammatical importance. We know that in the first century, in a political sense, that wasn't true because the Jews thought themselves to be superior. But Paul says it's all for the Jew and also for the Greek. They did not express them. That word also means in like manner, in similar fashion. If there is a difference between what Jesus spoke to the Jews and what Paul spoke to the Greeks, it wouldn't be in similar fashion. There'd be a difference. There is no difference. But as I said before, the Terrence McLean out here wants to get around baptism. Some of our brethren want to put these books in the Old Testament so they can get around what Jesus taught in terms of divorce and remarriage. But there's something I want to show you here. Consider this chart for just a few minutes. Along the first row is Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6. This is what Jesus taught about separation. The other four rows there are the Corinthian letter. This is what Paul wrote about the separation. Notice in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus said, "Let man," which a better translation of that word anthropos is mankind, "let human beings that God has joined together," he said that before in Matthew 19:6, "let them not separate." Now notice what Paul says when he comes down to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 10, a wife. Now is a wife part of mankind? Is the wife a human being? I expect somebody to say, sometimes. But she's in that category. That word "not" that Paul uses there in 1 Corinthians 7:10 is exactly the same Greek word that Jesus used in Matthew 19:6. And to depart is from koraizo. They're both the same word. So Paul has the same sentence structure, the same command in 1 Corinthians 7:10. Now drop down to verse 11 in 1 Corinthians. A husband, now ladies, you get to smile now. Is a husband part of mankind? Is the husband a human being? Well, so it fits in that category. Got the same Greek word translated "not," and then it says to divorce. Well, that word is aphemiae. The only difference between koraizo and aphemiae in the Greek is a method of sending, putting room between. Koraizo means to put room between. Aphemiae means to send forth. So it's the difference of whether you leave the house or she leaves the house, but the result's still the same. Now we drop down to 1 Corinthians 7:12, and here Paul, as most of us recognize, he addressed specifically the case where the marriage is between a believer and an unbeliever. Let him, well, is him part of mankind? Yeah. Still got the same word "not." Still got the same word "aphemia." And then we drop down to verse 13, let her, yeah, she's part of that mankind also, isn't she? Still same word "not," still the same word "aphemia." And all I'm trying to point out here, we're not going to be talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, is that Paul taught exactly the same thing that Jesus did about separation, didn't he? There's no difference. Where can you find the difference in the teaching? So here we've got somebody spending a whole lot of time running around a whole lot of verses trying to say that what Jesus taught and what Paul taught were exactly different. And in just a few minutes here, you can show what the result is. And now, you didn't make your point. You spent a lot of time, and the point is Jesus taught the same thing that Paul did, and Paul taught the same thing that Jesus did. The teaching is consistent. And I thought when Brother Keith did that lesson, he put up a lot of scriptures that this guy was using, and he went by to Indianapolis by way of Atlanta to try to prove that the marriage things were different, and they're really not, are they? There's no difference. Let's move on. Let's move on down to verse 17. And as it says, Paul says there, "For in it the gospel," and we're in it, and it means the gospel, "the righteousness of God is revealed from faith unto faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith." Here's another reason why Paul was not ashamed to preach this gospel, because in that gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. I think a lot of people back then had this idea that there were many gods, but in this one Paul is saying what was right with God, what was just with God, is being made known to us through the revelation, through his preaching of the gospel and what he had to say. We also have to take note that God had his plan from the beginning, didn't he? Before the earth was made. And so as we look at the Old Testament, and we understand Moses wrote the book of Genesis from there on, but three ages, the patriarchal age, the mosaical age, and the Christian age. The gospel started to be revealed back in Genesis, didn't it? Don't we find some prophecies back there concerning Christ? Don't we find some examples throughout this whole Old Testament that Paul will refer to later on in the New Testament, saying that these things happened to them for our example, for our learning? Romans chapter 15 and verse 4 says the things that took place back there were from our learning. So when we put things together, all the prophets, all the Old Testament scriptures testify of Christ as part of the gospel. They were put there as a tutor to us. It was put there to bring the Jews to Christ, but it can bring us too, because we can examine what happened to them. We can examine the prophecies and we can find out. Now, what he says now is the just shall live by faith. We understand again from the Roman letter that faith cometh by hearing. Their faith was going to come from the hearing of Paul's gospel. And when we hear it, we're going to understand what is just and what is not just. If we are just, Paul says, you will walk or you will live by faith. You will do the things that God will have you to do. You cannot walk by faith and rob your parents. You cannot walk by faith and hate your wife. You cannot walk by faith and sneer at the gospel. And we could just keep right on going and going, because there are a lot of things that this book tells us that we need to do as far as our lives are and the conduct of those lives, that we need to be living by faith. And if we're just, we're going to try our very best to do everything that's in the book. So it says then that the just shall live by faith. And Paul is not ashamed to preach that. And if you think about it, who can condemn what the Bible tells us to do? Who can say that it is not good? Who can say that it is not beneficial? Even if there were no heaven, I believe there is, if we lived the way the Bible wanted us to live, we could be very happy on this earth, couldn't we? We wouldn't have a lot of pain and a lot of sorrow with some of it. But Paul goes on to talk about in verse 18, for the wrath of God is also revealed. Now, we've looked at this first one over here, which says the righteousness of God is revealed. And this one says the wrath of God. So in it we have this twofold presentation. We have on the one hand the righteousness of God, and on the other hand we have the wrath of God. And we understand that when the gospel is preached, there is two approaches. God approaches some people in the method of fear. He says there is a hell where you're going to weep, you're going to gnash your teeth, the fires are never quenched. And that is intended to put some little bit of fear into your mind. On the other hand, he says there's a heaven where the streets are paved with gold and the houses are built out of jewels, and all is glory up there. There's no pain and no sorrow. So where Paul is saying, yeah, I can preach this salvation, I can preach this righteousness, but also I can show you that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men. Again, as we look at the Old Testament, what happened back then when unrighteousness took place? And it's not just in this book that we can read it. Secular history, world history, can point back to the things, the very things that happened here, and show that this Bible is actually relating the things that are there. But Paul says, I know the righteousness of God, I know the wrath of God, and it's revealed, the wrath part of it, against those who did wrong. Again, in the Old Testament, remember the flood? Would you say that was the wrath of God? Why did God flood the earth? Do you remember Sodom and Gomorrah? Why did God destroy them? Because they were doing right? No. How about the parting and the closing of the Red Sea? You spent a lot of time back there in Genesis and Exodus talking about this captivity. And every time Moses went to Pharaoh, his heart was hardened, his heart was hardened, his heart was hardened. And finally, his heart got soaked. God opened up the Red Sea. They drove into the Red Sea. And when they were in there, he closed the waters on them and killed them all. Was his wrath because Pharaoh was doing right? Talked a little bit this morning about the destruction of the foot of Mount Sinai. Remember what happened when Moses came down out of the mountain? Found them worshiping the calf? What are you saying, Paul? The wrath of God is shown by the things that we see in the Old Testament. But notice what this does. When people are ungodly, when people are unrighteous, the truth is suppressed. We talk about our influence. We talk about our image. But when we sin, truth is suppressed. When we do righteousness, what do we do with the truth? Don't we demonstrate it? So if we're going to be ungodly and we're going to be unrighteous, then we're also going to suppress the truth. If we want the truth to go out, then we've got to be the examples that God wants to be. But But again, Paul was not afraid to preach this gospel, even in the face of some of those who suppressed the truth. And in Paul's day and age, some of that truth was suppressed rather forcefully, wasn't it? With beatings and other things. But he goes on, and he says, now, we've seen the righteousness of God, we've seen the wrath of God. And he said, now, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. And he goes on a little bit later in the next verse and says, they are without excuse. Yeah, people today are without excuse too. For even without the revelation, even without this text, cannot we look about and see the presence of God? Think about it. Every day the sun comes up, the sun goes down. Like clockwork. Every time your diaphragm drops, you suck in air. What's in that air? The breath of life. Every time you look around, sometimes you get a little older, your vision gets a little better, but if you're able to see, you can focus in on the things that are close, you can look at the things that are far. How's that work? Who designed that? Trees. You know, we're coming into the springtime when we're going to have a rapid rebirth. The buds are already on some of the trees, and pretty soon there'll be green leaves. And guess what? About 6 months later, they'll turn brown and away they go. Happened for 4,000 years. Who designed it? Doesn't even nature itself point to the fact that there is intelligent design? I have not seen a thing yet that man has made that is comparable to the human body. Nothing. But he talks about these things that says they are shown for the since the creation of the world as invisible attributes being clearly seen and understood by the things that are made. You know, the things that were made were here a long time before I was born. How long has the earth been here? How long have the trees been growing? How long have the horses been there? How long has the air been there? How long has the sun been there? But he says we can understand, we can know that there is a God by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Not only can we look at that, but we can look at history. We've already done that, haven't we? How God has punished those who were ungodly, how God has rewarded those who are righteous. He says they were out excuse, and the reason they're out excuse is because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts. Notice the result of being unthankful, knowing the result of not paying attention to heaven. They became futile in their thoughts. Did you ever hear the word evolution? Futile thoughts. Ever hear the Tower of Babel? We're going to build this tower up to where God is. Futile thought, wasn't it? And so we have today even religious men who are concocting all of these theories that you can't find in the Bible, but being ungodly, being unthankful, they are still trying to come up with these futile thoughts. These things put it in there. But again, as we look there in their thoughts, it says their foolish heart was darkened. And what that says in there is that the powers, the mental powers, intellectual powers, and faculties have been darkened. We use a term a lot of times, we cannot see the forest for the trees. This is the condition that most people are in when they have these futile thoughts, when they don't pay attention to what the gospel. But Paul was not ashamed to offer his gospel in the presence of these futile thoughts. Some people say, oh, you got to preach to who you're talking to. You go talking to a bunch of sciences, you got to preach science. You go talking to a bunch of group over here, you've got to do that. Paul says, no, I'm not ashamed to preach this gospel that offers salvation to you in the midst of all these false doctrines, in the midst of all these futile thoughts, if you will. Here's some more reasons that Paul was going to talk about. He says, professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. You know, that word professing to be wise there is just another word for pretending. Have you ever seen anybody pretend to be wise? I know I probably told you about the one guy that used to work in our model shop over there, used to dress up in a suit, run into the locker room, change into his work clothes, work all day, go shower, get back into his suit and leave because he wanted his neighbors to think he was an engineer. He was pretending to be wise. Now, he may have been wise, but he certainly wasn't an engineer at the time. But these people with pseudo things, pretending to be wise, they became fools. You know what happens? When we set ourselves above God, we take foolish risks, don't we? When we put God in second place, we become fools. And that's what these people were doing. Remember Mars Hill, how many idols they had over there? Do you think any of those idols were erected or preached about or talked about because somebody was professing to be dumb? Now, professing to be wise, they became fools. And what they did then, they began to change the glory of the incorruptible God into things that already existed. Now, if this God is the creator of the world, or is a creature greater than the creator, which is exactly the argument Paul makes at the end of this particular verse. But because they had done all this, because they had become foolish, it says God gave them up to uncleanness. And again, we've talked a couple of times in the Bible class and everything else about being free moral agency. God lets you do what you want to do. He's not going to hold you back. You know, we often see in the cartoon characters, and I always remember Snuffy Smith had a little Snuffy with horns on one shoulder and another Snuffy with wings on the other, and they were always arguing back and forth about what they were going to let him do. God doesn't have those things up there. He doesn't pull back on the reins when you're going about to sin and say, "Whoa, you're a free moral agent. He's made you that way." But because they were consistent in this, he gave them up to uncleanness and lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. And in so doing, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Here are those futile thoughts, which are the lie. And God lets them go on with their futile thoughts. And he says, you've exchanged it. If you exchange the truth of God for a lie, haven't you exchanged heaven for hell? Isn't that the end of it? Paul's not afraid to say that. But he says, and they worship and serve the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. The creator is the one that deserves the worship. The creator is the one who needs to be listened to. He goes on in verse 26, says, for this reason God gave them up to vile passions. Now notice the progression that Paul is taking here. You've got righteousness and unrighteousness, you've got futile thoughts, you've got idol worship, and you've got all these things, and each one of these things leads to vile passions. When you look around the places like Corinth and some of these other places in the first century, they had temples of prostitutes. Is that a vile passion? Anything that man could be attracted to in his sinfulness, they had. And even to the point here where they begin to talk about homosexuality. He says, for even their women exchange their natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one for another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. In Matthew 19, where the Pharisees come testing Jesus about the divorce question, Jesus points them to the fact that in the beginning God made them male and female. And then he said, you know, therefore shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife. Now how did he design us? Male and female. What's the natural use? The way he designed us. The way we are made by nature. Men have done what is against nature. God did not design man to have a relationship with a man. He did not design a woman to have a relationship with a woman. And they said, these people in their vile passions and their futile thoughts have turned us upside down. And while a good number of them, perhaps in New Testament time, did not think prostitution was a vile passion, they did think that homosexuality was. And Paul goes to the most vile thing he could think of to illustrate the ends of futile thought. Did you ever notice that man, that human beings are the only violators of God's sexual law? You don't see male cats, nor male dogs, nor female cats involved with one another. Man is the only beast that God ever created that gets things turned backwards and upside down. But Paul is not ashamed then to preach the gospel in a society where there is error, where there is vile passions, and not afraid to state again that this is not right. But notice the last part of this verse is the penalty of their error, which was due. I've heard some people take this last particular thing here and talk about AIDS, that AIDS is the result of homosexuality, and it may be. But what Paul is talking about here is not AIDS. Paul is talking about the penalty that is due for sin. You have broken God's law by your relationships, and they are going to receive their penalty for their error. If they continue in that sin, they will be lost, and salvation will not be available to them. Here again is another reason. Not only did they have futile thoughts, not only did they have vile passions, but he says, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. You know, you may have listened to the sermon this morning. You may have listened to a sermon last week. One of the things I pointed out this morning was that John Fitzgerald Kennedy, in his inaugural address, says, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. People remember that, don't they? What was his next sentence? Do we know that? It's the same way with a lot of sermons. I have put the word birds up here. Do you remember what I had to say about birds? Yeah, that may be the only thing you remember about that sermon. But they don't like to retain God in their knowledge. They can look at all these things, but can we retain God in our knowledge? If we're going to avoid these things, we're going to have to like to retain God in our knowledge. But he said they didn't want to do it. They heard about God. They knew about God. They could see God in nature, but they didn't want to deal with it in their minds. So God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And you know, when you begin there with verse 29, I'm sure that this isn't a complete list of things that are not fitting, things that are debased, things that are not brought on by preaching the gospel. Notice what he says here, being filled with sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, and not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Now there's a pretty long list. Takes you two or three lungful of air to get through it. Did you ever notice a lot of uns in there? Unmerciful, unloving. It's not a positive statement. But God has given them over to this because this is the thing that happens. But even more frightening is that Paul says, who, and he's talking about the people that are in the world, who knowing the righteousness, remember the righteousness has been revealed, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things, here are the people in the flood, here are the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, here are other people that God has dealt with that are unrighteous, ungodly, who practice such things are worthy of death. They know that. But besides that, these are willing to copy their actions. They are willing to do the same thing. And not only willing to do it, they're willing to pat those on the back who practice and do the same things. Now, Paul is preaching a gospel here that preaches salvation. It preaches them that no or should know what God has done for them. They should know from their history what God does to those who disobey. But yet, in spite of all this evidence, they continue to do their things and they continue to approve those that do. Paul says the gospel that he preaches, salvation, will not affect that. Well, as then we've looked at the Apostle Paul here, we've learned that when he deals with the gospel, he limits salvation to believers. Remember Romans chapter 1 and verse 16. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation for those that believe. Belief begins with hearing. We talked a little bit this morning in three chapters over here in the book of Romans. He'll tell us that faith cometh by hearing. Belief comes by hearing. We can understand that God is, but we also need to know what He wants us to do. Once we become believers, the believer will confess God as the Creator, will confess His Son as the mediator of this new covenant. Once we become believers, then we will repent and turn from any of these actions we're committing that Paul says here in this last verse are worthy of death. We don't want to stay on that path once we become believers. We want to get off that path. We want to go someplace else that is a lot better than hell. So the believer will repent, then the believer is going to submit to baptism. Why? Because that's what Paul revealed. That's what Jesus revealed. That's what's being preached in the gospel. And then the faithful, like we talked about here, the faithful are going to retain God in their knowledge. The faithful are going to want to attempt to learn all they can about God and keep it there. And they're going to attempt to please God rather than to bring about His wrath. But Paul says that gospel has both righteousness and wrath. We know what it is. The faithful, however, are not perfect, and we can and often do sin. When this occurs, we have an advocate with the Father. We have the aid of our brothers and sisters. And we can help you, we can pray for you, we can pray with you, anything that you need. Whether you need to be obedient to the gospel, whether you need to be obedient to the gospel of salvation, or whether you need to invite our help, won't you make your wishes known as Brother Mark leads us in song.